Space, the final frontier. This is the Observer's Notebook, the official podcast of the Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers. Its mission to explore the solar system, to seek out new observations and data, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. And now the host of the Observer's Notebook, Tim Robertson.
Hello and welcome to episode 184 of the Observer's Notebook, the official podcast of the Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers. I'm Tim Robertson, host of the Observer's Notebook, and also the coordinator of the training program within the ALPO. Thank you for downloading and listening. The Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers collects and analyzes observations of various solar system bodies and associated phenomena, and publishes detailed reports concerning these bodies in its quarterly publication, the Journal of the Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers, also known as the Strolling Astronomer. This podcast depends upon donations from you, our listeners, to keep it alive. If you enjoy what you hear on the Observer's Notebook, you can donate to it via Patreon by giving as little as $1 a month. If you feel even more generous, for $5, you receive early access to the podcast before it goes public. For a monthly donation of $10, you receive a copy of the Novice Observer's Handbook. And for $35 a month, you receive producer credits on the podcast. You can help us out by going to www.patreon.com/observersnotebook. If you'd like to join the ALPO, you can for as little as $22 a year. For more information, you can find us on the internet at www.alpo-astronomy.org. And you can also find the ALPO on Facebook. Just search for ALPO Astronomy. And yes, this podcast also has a Facebook page as well. Just search for Observer's Notebook. And if you enjoy what you hear in the podcast, please subscribe. That way you'll never miss another episode. And now we're going to learn about teachers and how they're taught astronomy. Hope you enjoy it. All right, I'd like to welcome everybody back to this edition of the Observer's Notebook podcast. And today we have a very special guest, Professor Rika French. She earned degrees in astronomy and physics, spending years doing astrophysical research primarily on star clusters and planetary nebula, until she finally came to her senses and realized the targets she really wanted to talk about and talk to were college students and their instructors. She is the professor of astronomy and programs at MiraCosta College in Oceanside, California. Welcome to the podcast, Rika.
Hi, Tim. It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. Now, you came on my radar. I'm a Star Trek fan. And you came on my radar back in January. And that's when a podcast I listened to, the Trek Geeks, they hosted a fundraiser for the Hollywood Food Coalition. And you were on a panel with a past guest on this podcast, Dr. Erin McDonald. And yeah, you guys were talking about women in STEM. And that whole topic really interests me, and especially the stuff you talked about. So what brought you to that?
That's an interesting question with a very roundabout answer, I'm afraid. Okay. So let's see. I was that kid that always wanted to do science and math. I was one of those weirdos from right out of the gate. My parents didn't quite know what to do about that because neither of them, that was really their, not the, either of their fortes. So they really didn't know what to do with me about that. So I guess the thing that they decided to do was just make sure that we always went to museums and places of interest. So they did a really good job. They did the best they can with a weirdo kid like me. So yeah, we were always going on, when we went on family vacations, we'd go to state parks, national parks, and a lot of times we just go to museums. And I love the museums, especially the science and natural history museums. So anything that was, you know, physical science, a little bit of the biological science, but mostly the physical science, I was always into that. I was the classic, loved space. Oh, as a kid, I want to be an astronaut, which I still do. I still do. So if anybody's listening, I still do want to be an astronaut. I'll go.
Sounds good.
So that kid, as I came up through school, physical science, I did take physics in high school, but the physical sciences that you get in the American K-12 education system up to that point, those were always my strongest courses. And I always did really well in all of my math courses. When I was in junior high, I was one of those kids that got jumped ahead a couple of math levels because I wasn't really being sufficiently challenged in my current grade level. So I had, I was fortunate to go to what they call a magnet school for high school, which is one of the schools where you do have to have a certain GPA to even apply to the school.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the American South. I was born in Nashville, Tennessee, and sort of went all over North Carolina, Alabama, Chicago, and then ended up back in Nashville. So I actually did graduate from high school. I graduated from Hume Fogg Academic High School in Nashville. And so I was fortunate to take, well, all of their courses were either honors level courses or AP courses. They didn't have what high schools would call regular courses back then. So I took physics, I took AP calculus, I took AP physics, the algebra based version. And that was my thing. I just knew I was going to be some sort of engineer, you know, math science-y person. I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do because, you know, you can't just decide to go be an astronaut and go to school for that. So I started doing engineering. I started doing what I thought was probably going to be probably civil or aeronautical engineering. I was leaning towards the aeronautical because I was always interested in flying. And me and the space shuttle program are the same age. So I always had a fondness for the space shuttle. And so as kids, you know, my mom and dad always knew if they wanted to buy me some kind of gift that they didn't really know what to buy me, that anything with a space or a space shuttle on it was going to be a pretty safe bet for them. And so I started college. Actually, I didn't know what I was going to do exactly. I didn't have anyone to really guide me through that because neither of my parents had gone to college. My dad had some college courses when he was in the military, but again, neither of them actually attended college. So I was kind of the first generation, I guess, from that family then to go to college. And so I didn't really know that you could go meet with advisors and have them talk to you about what to do. So all I was doing was looking at a college catalog of courses going, hey, that sounds cool. Hey, that sounds cool. So I was just sort of doing my own thing. I was even a music major for a while when I was in college. Yeah. So I kind of went all the way around the world and then came back. When I finally kind of decided what I thought I was going to do, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to do aeronautical engineering. That's what it is. So I was going to do one of those 3-2 programs where I did the first 3 years at the school that I was at and then transfer to do 2 years and finish the degree at an engineering school. The problem was I'd already been in school for like 4 years at that point. So I was just a full-time student taking more courses and changing my mind and taking more courses and changing my mind. I didn't really have any guidance that way. When I finally decided on the aeronautical engineering, I applied and got accepted to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical Engineering, Aeronautical University. So yeah, I was ready, set to go. And then I had purchased a plane ticket. I was going to go and find a place to live. And so the person that I was dating at the time, the man that would later become my husband, you know, that trip we were going to take to Arizona to go find a place to live while I went to engineering school, I had to come home one day and tell him that and say, yeah, that's not going to happen. I changed my mind. We're going to major in physics now. And that's because the folks in the physics department, I was actually taking physics again because I thought it's probably not a good idea to show up to an engineering school with the last time having had physics been in high school. That's been a few years now. So I was trying to refresh my memory on what I was supposed to have learned in those courses. And the physics faculty, I think, was a small program at the time. And they got together because I was taking multiple physics courses and they only had two astronomy courses, but I took them both. And so I think a few of them got together and kind of decided, does anybody know what she's planning on doing? Because we think she should be a physics major.
So
I joke that they sort of cornered me because that's kind of what it felt like. I mean, it was all in you know, genuine good intentions. But, you know, still an undergrad, it was like, what is happening? Because one of them approached me after class one day and said, would you mind? Do you have a few minutes? You know, there's a couple of us that like to talk to you. And I was thinking, oh, crap, what's happened? What did I do? And so the joke that I tell is that they basically took me into a room that was sort of like an interrogation room and turned some lights on and all kind of stared at me and said, we want to know, why are you an engineering major? We think you should be a physics major. And it was
what did you think at that point?
I was deer in the headlights. I was like, wait, okay. First of all, they had to have done some homework on me. How did they know I was an engineering major? So obviously someone, you know, looked at my file.
Right.
And I didn't realize that they really knew who I was. I mean, the courses that I was taking, they weren't, you know, like the 300 person courses where you just disappear and you're a number, right? So it wasn't that bad. But at the same time, I didn't think that people paid that much attention. I didn't really know that instructors would actually take that much of a personal interest in someone. And plus, I remember thinking, I don't know, physics is hard.
Yes, it is.
I don't know about that. It seems like that's hard. I don't know. I don't know if I can pull that one off. The weird thing was, just probably a couple of weeks before that, I had actually entertained changing my major to chemistry because I thought, oh, I like the chemistry because it's math and it's this and it, I can do that. That surely I can do that, right? Mm-hmm. And then here they are presenting me with this physics major thing, and I'm thinking, oh crap, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But they put up a good argument, I have to say, because they talked to me. We got to know each other a little bit better than just the one way instructor student conversation that you usually have in courses. And I realized that they actually did kind of know me a little bit. They were paying attention. I didn't realize that. And so it was kind of nice to realize that even if you weren't, the star student or the one who always answered all the questions in class, that they still kind of knew who you were. That was different. That's interesting. For me.
So how did astronomy come into this?
Yeah. So I'd had those two astronomy courses as part of the taking the physics courses. And so the person who taught the astronomy course was actually one of them in what I called the interrogation room. And so they're like, yeah, if this is what you want to do, we can help you do this. And I thought, really? I don't even know what that means. I didn't even know being an astronomer was a thing. I seriously did not know that.
Were you interested in astronomy back then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it was space related, right? So therefore, that was super cool. I just didn't know that being an astronomer was a thing. Here I was an undergrad. I was probably already, 22, 23, maybe even 24 years old at that point. When I'm like, wait, people do that? Like, that's their job. Because I thought being an astronomer or owning a telescope was, I don't know, they have them on sale in Walmart. You can buy one of those little telescopes off the shelf in Walmart, right? That's what people do, right? Or the Sears catalog, because I was a kid in the 70s and 80s. So you could order one through the Sears catalog, right? And they're like, no. You've heard of the observatories. And I was like, well, yeah, but I don't know what they do with them. And here I'm thinking, wow, you're really showing how dumb and ignorant you are here. And they were like, no, that's a thing. They're staff people. They work there. Astronomers, they do astronomy and astrophysics. And really, I can do that? Yeah, if you're serious, then we'll help you. And I'm like, well, what does that have to do with the physics thing? And they're like, well, because remember, astronomy is physics. It's just physics of the stuff out there.
Right.
And so I'm like, I don't know. I don't think I can do it. They talked me into it. I left that day and changed my major to physics. And so that's when I had to go home and say, yeah, that whole engineering moving to Arizona thing, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Oh my.
So what do you want to do? We want to just go on vacation to Arizona. So we did. So we ended up just having this vacation in Arizona.
Nice guys in Arizona.
It is. And I didn't really know that especially Tucson, right? I didn't know that there was a national observatory there. I didn't know that the University of Arizona has one of the largest astronomy programs in the nation. I had no idea. Yeah.
The Vatican Observatory is in Arizona.
I had no idea. Yeah. I mean, I was just literally clueless. So that happened. And they were like, well, you can get your physics degree here. And then you'll be pretty well positioned to go to graduate school in astronomy if that's something you really want to do. And so, just more conversations with them eventually became, this is what's happening. So I was basically being groomed for the physics degree and then to go to graduate school in astronomy. That was the plan. I was terrified, but that was the plan. I was going to do it. And the difference this time was that I actually had people that supported me in the university, whereas I didn't have that before. I had people who knew who I was. They knew how to help me. They knew how to ask the right questions that I didn't even know needed asking. And so it's really because of them that I got into all of this in the first place. They had me apply to REU programs of research experiences for undergraduates, a lot of which are funded by the National Science Foundation. And so I got lucky and got chosen for one of those programs. And I remember thinking, when I applied, why would they bother picking me? I literally have zero experience in any of this. I mean, I'm barely getting by in these physics courses. And one of the people, the astronomy professor at the time had said, that's the point. That's what they're for. They just need to know that you're, can do some of this math and physics, that you've been exposed to this. But that's literally what the programs are for, to help you decide if this is really something you think you might want to do before you spend all this time studying for it, right? Maybe even going to graduate school and realizing, oh God, I hate this. Mm-hmm. So I got lucky. I did that program. And then the next year after that, I got selected for another one. And so that was kind of the steamroller effect, the accretion steamroller effect. And that's kind of how it happened. It was totally an accident.
That's a real interesting path. Then you got into some heavy duty research with star clusters and planetary nebula too.
Yeah. So that first summer research program that I did as an undergraduate, I worked on open clusters at the Mariah Mitchell Observatory on Nantucket, Massachusetts. And that was the director at the time. It was probably just the right person at the right time to be the kind of person to encourage in just the right way. And to, again, ask the right questions. I mean, I got so lucky kind of falling backwards into a group of people that were precisely the people that I didn't know that I needed at that point in time. And so the director at the time is largely responsible for me remaining in astronomy, gave me some confidence. I got to do some real astronomy. I got to do color magnitude diagrams of open clusters. They even took us to our first American Astronomical Society meeting where we got to present posters. And I'm sure you're familiar with Jay Pasikoff, who unfortunately passed away not that long ago. Jay Pasikoff was the very first person to ask me anything about astronomy. He was the first person to come up to my poster and ask me a question when I was an undergrad. My very first AAS, my very first poster, and Jay Pasikoff was the first person. Yeah.
That's pretty intimidating.
And I didn't know it at the time, right? Because I'm like, I don't know who this guy is, right? I didn't know all the stuff that he had done. I didn't know that he's probably, you know, witnessed more eclipses than any solar eclipses than any other human being probably on the planet. I had no idea. I don't know. But I don't know if he remembered me that way or not. But because I ended up being so involved in education and professional development for instructors later on and now in my career, we crossed paths quite often. And so he did know who I was in that respect, but I don't know if he ever knew. And I didn't really get a chance to say anything to him. The last AAS meeting that I saw him at, it was clear that he unfortunately wasn't well. You could tell that he was struggling a bit. And so I remember talking with another colleague about mine that said, wow, you know, I don't think Jay looks like he feels very well. And I thought, yeah, I really don't know. And then it wasn't, but just probably 3 or 4 months after that, that we had learned of his passing.
No, that's too bad. Now you went from doing some serious research to education. What happened to cause that?
Yeah. Because I did swear that I would never be a teacher.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I swore up and down. There's no way I'm not going to be a teacher. In fact, if you could just sit me behind a computer, either, you know, programming some sort of code that I'm working on or just reducing data from a telescope, because I loved observing. That was cool because I got to, you know, work with the telescopes and the instruments. And it was, you know, highly technical at the time. Mm-hmm. This was the early to mid 90s. And so I remember thinking, this is cool. You just sit me behind the computer screens. And if I never have talked to another human being ever again, that's probably fine. I'm probably good. That's exactly, I'm good. And then in graduate school, I ended up having to do several things in order to, you know, support myself. I had to do either a research appointment or a teaching appointment, depending upon what kind of funds were available in the department to support the grad students. And so I did end up being a TA for several courses. I did end up doing research that it's not that I wasn't interested in at all, but it wasn't what I wanted to be researching. It was interesting. I worked on Cepheid variables for a while. I worked on metal poor halo stars for a while, all of which was really interesting, just not really what I wanted to do. And the thing that I ended up thinking, wow, I don't know if I'm any good at this or not, but it seems to be the thing that I can focus on the most without worrying about what other people think of me, because I think I had that complex of, I was older when I went to grad school, because I had spent so many years as an undergrad, I was older than, the incoming class in graduate school. So I wasn't, you know, like the pre-programmed 18-year-old into college, 4 years flat, you're out, done, you're in grad school by 22. I was definitely several years older. And so I was one of the oldest ones, probably the second to oldest one admitted in my class of incoming grad students. And so I ended up just kind of, like I said, doing different research things and then TAing. And one of the courses that I was a TA for was the introductory astronomy lab, the observing lab for non-science majors. So that course that the folks come in and just need their physical science lecture and lab credit. And that lab course was the one that they took if they wanted to do astronomy. And I remember thinking the first couple of times that I was guiding students through this course that I thought, I don't understand why this is this way, because this feels too much like a lecture course And it's supposed to be more hands-on than this. Mm-hmm. We have all these telescopes. We have all this equipment. We could be doing all this cool stuff. And it wasn't that we weren't using any of it. It's just, I felt like it was way too much of just a lecture course where we could be doing more stuff with more of our stuff if we could just figure out the right way to do this. And so I remember going to a couple of the faculty there and just kind of asking, you know, are there rules? I'm sure there are about, you know, what's supposed to be taught in these courses. And of course, I didn't know anything about online courses of record and how they had to be approved. And they had to be in some schools, they have to be articulated with other institutions through the state. I didn't know any of this. And I've got lucky I got lucky in that Mary Kay Hemenway, who is one of the biggest names in astronomy education during that time period, she was kind of a trailblazer of her own, was one of the ones that agreed to work with me. She said, if you want to change some of this, I'll help you do it. I'll help you do it. And we'll make sure that you know, it kind of encapsulates the things that you're thinking of, because now that I go through it, I think you might be right about some of this. So let's see what we can do. And so she gave me some pointers and I attempted to redesign the whole course. And basically what happened is, with her guidance, we did. We ended up just redoing the whole entire course. And I thought, I don't know, I kind of like that part of it. I don't know. It wasn't so much about the teaching itself, but I really enjoyed learning about pedagogy and learning about different learning sequences and how to approach them and what kind of assessments are good for this, the difference between a formative and a summative assessment. So I learned all that kind of stuff because we didn't have courses in that. I mean, my graduate school was fortunate in that we actually did have what we called the teaching course, but it was just one course on, I hesitate to say how to teach because it wasn't exactly like that, but it did teach you a little bit about pedagogy. But again, it was taught by, actually, I think ours was taught by astronomers, which is fine. It's just, I don't know if any of those astronomers had special training, or were we just trying to make sure that we cover our bases in that pretty much everyone that goes to graduate school in astronomy is going to end up teaching at some point in their career. So maybe we don't want to send them out into the world having zero experience, especially if they didn't TA. So I think that was the purpose of that course. But anyway, we ended up redesigning that course. And I remember when I would hold office hours and having a conversation with a couple of my office mates, and one of them said, you know, you are so full of it. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. She goes, you complain and complain about how you don't like teaching and you don't like being a teacher and you wish you didn't have to do this. And she's probably right. I don't know. But she said, you're so full of it because these students, they come into our office for office hours and you just help them. And you listen to them and you're so kind with them and you're compassionate and you ask questions of them so that they can participate. And I just remember thinking, really? You got all that from... I did not consciously realize that I was doing that. I think I just felt like it's my duty because the way that school handled it, we weren't the instructor of record, but we were basically left alone, right? If you didn't make sure you weren't doing anything weird, then nobody, you know, kind of checked on you. And so it was kind of up to you to make sure you were doing what you're supposed to be doing in that class. And so I took that pretty seriously. And when students would come to me for help, I tried to look at it from that perspective of if I were one of them, because I actually took Astro 101 when I was in school and I took the observing lab.
Yep, we all did. Yeah.
Majors. Yeah. Yep. I mean, I took that because I didn't know what I was doing at the time. Right. So I was them. And so I tried to think about it like that. Like if I was them, I would expect this person to help me, but I also need to make sure that they understand I'm just not, you know, trying to freeload off of them. I'm trying, but I'm really struggling. And so I guess I really internalized that. And when my office mate said that, I remember thinking, oh, crap, that means I'm going to be a teacher, right? Because it doesn't matter how old you get. You kind of always hate it when your parents are right. My mom, I think, probably knew by the time I was in third grade, I think my mom knew that I was going to be a teacher. She said it at many different times that you'd make a really good teacher. And I was like, oh God, nah, that's not happening. Blah. But I remember playing school when I was a kid and I was always the teacher and my brother was the poor unsuspecting pupil, unfortunately for him. So that might explain why I actually ended up being a teacher and why he ended up hating school.
Wow. Yeah. Yes. I'm surrounded by teachers. My son teaches fifth grade up in Oregon. My wife, She's a retired second grade teacher of 36 years. Yes. Her mother was a teacher. You know, my brother's a math professor at a college in LA. So I've got teachers all around me. But there's one thing they all have in common. They all had a teacher that motivated them when they were young. Do you have someone like that?
I think I always am going to come back to those certain particular members of the physics department at Middle Tennessee State University when I was an undergrad there, mm-hmm. because I think they're really responsible. Them and Eileen Friel, who was the director of the Mariah Mitchell Observatory at that mm-hmm. time that I was the summer student there. And some of them I've kept in touch with and some of mm-hmm. them I lose touch with, but we always end up reconnecting eventually at some mm-hmm. point. But I really do think it really is true that if it weren't for them mm-hmm. altogether, that I definitely wouldn't have gone down the path that I
they had. All saw something in you that you did not see yourself.
I think they must have. They must have, because I was absolutely convinced that I was not going to be a people person by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, I'm not sure that I'm not. And if anybody who knows me really well is listening to this, they're probably laughing their butts off right now because they know. Yeah. When I'm done with my teaching workday, I kind of don't want to talk to people.
Well, that's understandable. Yeah, that's understandable.
The switch gets flipped, right? And that's usually how I describe it. When it's time for me to go into the classroom, I try to flip that switch and I try not to let it matter, you know, what else is going in my life. I mean, you can't always do that, but I try not to bring all of that baggage into the classroom.
You went kicking and screaming into the classroom, but are you passionate about it?
I am. I'm afraid that I am. I have to own up to it. Yeah.
What feeds that passion?
The sky is free, or at least it should be for everyone. And I'm one of those people that got really lucky in that I got to learn about the sky and had those people, like you were just saying, the people that motivated me to continue doing what I was doing, not so much when I thought I couldn't do it, but when I wasn't sure that's what I wanted to, mm-hmm. but something about the way those individuals interacted with me made me think not only could I probably could pull this off. I probably could do it, but you actually kind of like it. So you might as well just get over yourself mm-hmm. and go ahead. And I try now, because my focus population is the science for non-science folks. Mm-hmm. So I do teach almost exclusively those students who are taking the Astro 101, the Intro Labs, sometimes an Intro Physical Science course, but it's almost always the courses for students who have self-selected against STEM fields. So they're just looking, you know, they're liberal arts students that are just looking for that physical science credit. They want out. They want path of least resistance. And they see astronomy and they're like, woohoo, that's got to be it, right? Because chemistry, physics, oh dear Lord. Occasionally geology. I live near a coast, so oceanography is a big deal. So really kind of oceanography and astronomy are the two. And oceanography wins where I am right now. But mm-hmm. but astronomy is the other, like, because everybody thinks it's cool, right? Yeah. Astronomy in space is cool. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we get the rest of them that oceanography doesn't bring over to the dark side. And so that's my focus population. And so I kind of try to approach it like I was saying before. I was them once. Now it's true that I always liked the math and science, and I could always mm-hmm. I could do it. It came easier to me than other things, and that's not true for most of them. But at the same time, I didn't know that I was going to do that, and I didn't know how interested I would become. And I don't know that that's not going to happen for any of them. And even if it doesn't happen in astronomy or science in general, some of them are going to be teachers because mm-hmm. they're general education students. So I want them to have a good experience, because we so often don't in courses, both in college and, like I said, the American K-12 education system. And it's not usually the teacher's fault, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. They end up having to teach things that maybe they weren't ready for or they didn't sign up to teach. And so a lot of them are putting in really unfortunate positions, and it gives the American public education system a bad name. And there's a lot of issues there, but I try to always keep that in my mind that I don't know what their experiences were before they got to me, but I don't want them to have a bad experience. And I want them to leave thinking, I can think like a scientist, even if I think I can't, I actually can. And I can show you how. Mm-hmm. And humans are born scientists, right? I mean, we have these brains that are just capable of the most amazing things. And when you're a child, that's one of the things that's how you learn about the universe you live in.
True.
you throw things, you drop things, and it makes parents angry. But at the same time, most of the time, it's the kid conducting an experiment. And that's not even, they don't even know they're doing that. But they don't know that when you keep knocking the book off the table over and over and over again, that the same thing will happen. Not only mom yelling at you, but they don't realize that. They're mm-hmm. learning about gravity. They have right. no idea that that's what they're going to do. And so often, we end up having a bad experience in a math or a science course. And it kind of sucks that desire for investigation. It sucks that desire for knowledge right out of you. And I hate that. That hurts me. I just am physically pained every time I have to think about that. Mm-hmm. So when by the time they get to me, I know that some of them had those kinds of experiences, and I want to make it be anti that. I want to make it be total now, opposite.
Now, having the students that you have currently, the liberal arts ones, you say, have you ignited a spark in any of them to look at astronomy a little deeper?
Actually, yes. I am happy to say I actually, one of my first ones that I had at MiraCosta, so long ago, it's got to be at least 15 years ago, I think. He actually went on to Berkeley and got a degree in planetary science.
Oh, my.
There have been some others
that's got to feel good.
It does. It really does. And we're still in touch. So we still hear from each other occasionally. Mm-hmm. And so that's really nice to know. And then let's see, there's another one that works. I want to say in aerospace engineering, but it's definitely in a STEM technical field and is still in touch with me. In fact, I got an email from him probably just a semester or two ago. Just, hey, you know, checking in, just wanted to see what's going on. There's been a few. There's others that have gone on to other scientific fields. We have a big biotech program at my institution. And so occasionally I'll get a couple of them. And so there's definitely some of them that, and they've stayed in science. They, you know, took me as the physical science credit that they needed because they were going to get all the biology they need right through their mm-hmm. biotech program. But they took me for that physical science credit. And a couple of them have kept in touch as well. In fact, I just got an email from one of them this week, I think. What day is this? Thursday. I just got an email from one this week. He's like, do you remember me? I was the guy that did this, this, this. And I'm like, of course I remember you. And so he's like, I'm in town. Want to know if we could stop by and catch up for a few minutes. And so, yeah, it happens. And it really is
good.
It does make you feel good. Yeah.
That's great. Now, your focus is also on teaching teachers and working with educating them in the field of astronomy.
Yeah. So let's see.
How does that work?
Yeah, in 2005, I think it was. I got my position at MiraCosta in 2004, and it was at the American Astronomical Society meeting in 2005, in January of 2005, which was in San Diego. And there was this teaching workshop, and I remember thinking, that's cool, because, you know, I'm in it now. Yep. You're in it deep now. So I should probably, you know, professional development is certainly a requirement at some level, but also it's the, no, I'm really in it now and I need to try and do the best job that I can. And I don't feel like I'm as prepared as I could be. So I'm going to sign up for this workshop. So I did. It was from the Center for Astronomy Education, which I didn't know at the time was brand new. They'd only been around for maybe a year or two tops, if I remember correctly. A couple of years, I think. And it was sort of an immersive all day kind of thing where they just kind of throw you in the deep end, but they didn't leave you to sink or swim. They definitely guided you through certain activities of assignments.
What was this for? Yeah. This was for educators?
It was for educators, but it was at the American Astronomical Society meeting. Okay. So everybody there's an astronomer.
Okay.
And this was also during the time when, weirdly enough, there weren't nearly as many resources to support folks teaching astronomy, mm-hmm. whether it was for the, you know, non-science folks, gen ed population, or whether it was for majors and minors. There weren't many resources from AAS that people knew about. And the ones that we did know about, we just lagged behind some other disciplines, say like math, for example, and like biology. We lagged behind them a little bit in terms of professional development for those of us that were going to, you know, be in the trenches with the students. And so everybody in the room was an astronomer. And it was also at the time where there was some resistance to what now many are calling active learning. that phrase means a lot of different things, I think, to a lot of different people now. But it was basically that idea that you can't, the students, you know, they're not empty vessels, right? You don't just flip top, open the head, pour all your knowledge in, and then you're good to go. I mean, you're not blank. They're not blank slates. They know stuff. Some of it's not good stuff, and it's not their fault, right? They've either developed these either incomplete or incorrect mental models as a result, a direct result of poor instruction, which unfortunately happens, and misinformation that they've seen or heard somewhere. But a lot of times they've just had to figure it out on their own. And we don't always figure it out the correct way if we're left on our own. And so you have to really come at it from that angle. I mean, having to unlearn something is one of the hardest things that any human being has to do, regardless right. of what it is you're supposed to be learning, right? You've got all these ideas already. And if there are things that these are beliefs and thoughts that you've had for many, many years, you don't let go of those very easily. Somebody's got to give you a really good reason to let go of those. And so the unlearning and trying to convince people that you can call yourself a teacher, but that's not really what happens. You don't teach people. They teach themselves. And we've known this for literally thousands of years. But you can guide them. You can facilitate that. And you can give them tools and guide them in ways that makes it a much less painful process for them. And that's my job. And that's the approach that those people in the workshop had. That, you know, the people need to be active learners. They need to be involved in constructing their own knowledge. They need to be involved in critical reasoning. And I think especially the gen ed astronomy courses kind of got left out because astronomy was just, woohoo, there's this big old universe. And yeah. Look, there's the solar system and planets. And hey, memorize the tilts of the planets. And oh my God, why? I mean, why? Yeah. What are you going to do with that when you leave school? How is that useful to you? And it unfortunately became one of those things where you just memorize a bunch of crap. That's pretty much it. And you look at pretty pictures and you memorize stuff. That's great. But it's really not the thing that we should have been doing with that time. We should have been helping them learn about it instead of memorizing a bunch of stuff that you'll never need ever in the rest of your life. And you'll forget most of it, right? You walk through the magical, mystical doorframe of the classroom, it erases your brain, you've crammed it for a test, and then you walk through the doorframe and it's all gone. So why don't we think we should be doing that better? That's kind of what the folks at the Center for Astronomy Education, that was one of their kind of guiding principles. We not only think we should be doing better, we know we can. There is education research that shows that these things are possible, and astronomy is lagging behind in that respect. So
astronomy is moving very fast too.
It is now. You're definitely right.
And to lay behind, I mean, some subjects, if you're not up on this week's things happening, you're lagging behind. It's crazy. The stuff that's being discovered in astronomy nowadays too.
That's true.
What's your personal opinion of the state of science education in the United States?
Not good. I won't say abysmal, but it's not good. And I don't know that we can really play a blame game at all. I'm not sure that there's any one entity that's more responsible for that than any of the others. I think we've kind of hit one of those low points in what I hope is a cyclical set of processes where a whole bunch of unfortunate things have come together in just the right way at just the right time to kind of drag down what we're doing, especially in terms of science and mathematical literacy in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just got us down in this rut. And I'm hoping that, like I said, that it's cyclical. I hope in that there's going to be an upturn. And I don't know if there's a magic switch to flip. I don't know if there's a magic pill for that, but those of us at CAE, the Center for Astronomy Education, we've worked pretty hard for our little corner of the world. I'll say that physics education research has sort of led the way. They were into it well before astronomers were. So the good news is we had a lot of really fantastic shoulders to stand on when we wanted to start doing it ourselves. And CAE was definitely one of the forefront leaders. And so we've had the benefit of what the physicists have, you know, figured out and been able to show some of what works and what doesn't work and some of the biases and some of the ways that you're inadvertently disadvantaging people in the classroom. And, you know, you didn't even realize it. And so astronomy has now kind of, I think we've caught up. I think we're doing a good job catching up. I kept attending more of those CAE workshops at AAS meetings, and I kept doing it to the point where we were joking about me being a stalker of the facilitators. And so that's kind of what it was. I just basically stalked them until they gave in and started letting me participate. And by that, I mean, they realized that I kept coming back and coming back. And so when they would have a group of instructors that would kind of express reservations over a certain technique or a certain material, type of material or something like that, there were a handful of us in the room that could say, you know what? I felt the same way as you did. I thought exactly the same thing. There's no way that's going to work. I can't do that. My style isn't, all those kinds of things, all those negative things. And then we've had such amazing experiences that we're the ones here to show you it can work. It can work. We've been there. We've done that. Exactly the thought process that you're going through right now. We've mm-hmm. done that before. And so it became that. And then eventually I got to start help actually facilitating, be a named facilitator in the workshop. And a few years after that, I said many years after that, we had a person that had worked with us for a really long time, had to step away for some health reasons. And then I sort of got moved into that position of associate director. And okay. So now we're trying to spread the love, I guess you'd say. It's we don't have as much funding as we used to. That's a problem for everybody, I think, probably. Mm-hmm. So we don't do as many workshops as we used to, but we're all also starting to look at not just the general education population, but also the majors and minors programs in astronomy and astrophysics and planetary science and that kind of stuff, because it turns out, I mean, the same techniques are going to work for them. It's right. just the level, right, of expertise that you're trying to move them towards. And so we're starting to look towards that. And so we've involved a whole lot of people over a whole lot of time. I forget what the statistics are, but there's easily over 1,000 Astro 101 instructors that have been through a CAE workshop.
Okay. Now, what about middle school and high school level teachers that might have, like when I was in high, I went to school, high school in the '70s, and the high school I went to, they had a 12.5-inch Newtonian telescope, this huge cave telescope.
Yeah.
No one knew how to operate. I was an amateur astronomer since I was 9. So I had 2 telescopes at the time. I had read every book in the library about astronomy, and I went to that class. I took the astronomy class, and the textbook they were using said, I remember one distinct thing, it said Saturn had 9 moons. Well, in 1972, it was well known it had more than 9 moons. But he, yeah. On the test that the teacher gave us, he asked, how many moons does Saturn have? So I think I put down 14 or whatever was the time, and he marked it wrong. Because the book we had was written 15 years before.
Yeah.
You know, I ended up being a TA for him my senior year. And so taking funny. The telescope out at night, doing star parties with the students and stuff like that. But I realized early on that just because you're teaching the subject doesn't make you an expert in the subject.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I know astronomy is introduced in the middle schools and they have it in the high school. So have you guys worked with that level of educator?
We definitely have a significant fraction of high school instructors. Okay. Once the CAE's workshops started gaining some traction, and people started to be like, oh, so I've heard of that, but I don't know anything about that. And, you know, kind of word of mouth started, you know, propagating that, oh, if you're interested in teaching Astro 101, you know, maybe she should try that out. There was a lot of cool things that happened in that workshop. So that kind of happened. And after there was some momentum with that, we started getting high school instructors enrolling. Okay. And also, too, because they weren't just holding workshops at American Astronomical Society meetings. They were actually going to schools all over the nation.
Good.
Even in Puerto Rico, they were doing some. I want to say Canada, too, but I can't remember. That was before I was involved as an instructor. But yeah, they would usually partner either with a 4-year institution or sometimes with a 2-year school, so a community college or a junior college.
Okay.
And so they would just get somebody to agree to host it and, you know, get some cooperation for the facilities. And then they would host what sort of came to jokingly be known as the 2-day boot camp workshop. And so you'd have an all-day Saturday and Sunday workshop. And so there's definitely a significant fraction of high school students there, because we realized that many of the Astro 101 students in college are basically 9-month-old high school graduates. It's pretty much all they are. So they're not that different from high school students. In fact, they're rarely different at all, especially if they're the students that selected against math and science fields. So the materials even that we were developing and field testing and that were research validated and that we were using to help facilitate active learning sequences were appropriate, just as appropriate for the high school students as they were for our Astro 101 students at introductory college level. And then I think what started happening is the high school teachers, I think, made enough noise wherever they were that all of a sudden you started getting more word of mouth, and there would occasionally be maybe a middle school teacher. But usually what happened was I think folks that had participated at the high school level, just sort of, it was a trickle down effect, mm-hmm. maybe. That they would then go and just talk about what they'd done. And so middle school teachers could see that at that point. It's funny that you talk about how a lot of them aren't trained in astronomy, and it's mm-hmm. not just the K-12 instructors. In fact, we now know that it's over 80%. I forget the statistic, which is embarrassing a little bit because I did actually write about it a few years ago. It was a chapter in a book I contributed. And so that was one of the statistics that I put in there, but it's over 80%. Of instructors at two-year colleges in the U.S., so community colleges, junior colleges, over 80% of the folks in those schools that are teaching astronomy, that are teaching Astro 101, have had absolutely no formal training in astronomy whatsoever. Wow. Some of them have never even taken an astronomy course. And that is, well, we knew it was pretty common, but to have a statistic that shows over 80% is just, that floored me.
That's scary.
It is. It really is.
You're just looking at a sliver. You're just looking at astronomy.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And how many is that true for in, the K-12 system? Because the mm-hmm. next generation science standards have astronomy. They have earth science. Right. They have space science.
Right.
So, yeah. And I've also, I had the good fortune to be involved with a group called the K-12 Alliance in California. And one year I actually did a week-long kind of workshop-y thing with them where it was right about the time that the NGSS standards, the Next Generation Science Standards, were going to be put into play in the United States. And there were these pilot groups of teachers who had decided to become what they called early implementers. And so there was this early implementer workshop, set of workshops all over California, apparently, that they were taking those standards to try and look and see, okay, how are these different from what we've been doing? And then what can we do? How can we turn this into a good experience, right? And towards that whole, we want to positively impact the state of scientific and mathematical literacy in the United States. So how can we do the best job that we can? And they were really forward thinking, and they reached out to professionals in the different fields. And it was kind of, this person told this person told this person, ended up asking me, hey, do you want to be one of the discipline experts? Because you do that and the professional development. So we think you'd be a good fit. And I was like, yeah, when is it happening? So I got lucky and got to work with a bunch of fifth grade teachers mm-hmm. on the next generation science standards in astronomy. And so I got to share many of the Center for Astronomy Education's research validated materials with them. We got to talk about the ways that we approach some of these learning sequences and just some of the, general ideas behind it. And we all had a really good experience. I think the teachers were just, they were like sponges. They were just mm-hmm. soaking this stuff up, and they were so eager. And it just it reinforced that belief to me that it's so not the teacher's fault, right? When the system gets such a bad rap, it is overwhelmingly not their fault. They're just not, they don't have the resources, many of them, that they really need. And they certainly don't have the time that they need to try and implement something that could make what I think might be a huge sea change, right? In the state of scientific and mathematical literacy in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that makes me sad. But at the same time, it was really cool to see, wow, they teach fifth graders. I could never do that. I can't do that population.
Trust me. I've been in
classrooms. Your family sounds like it's full of saints.
Yes, they are. There's a passion that they absolutely love it. And what are some of the most common misconceptions of astronomy that you hear from other educators?
No gravity in space.
Hmm.
And that's true not just of teachers that may not have had the courses that they would have liked to have had before they got thrown into a classroom in that position. But that's just true of the general population. In fact, three of the top misconceptions in astronomy are there's no gravity in space. Seasons are caused by the distance between the Earth and the sun. And moon phases are caused by the Earth's shadow blocking light.
So
those are the top three.
Well, as long as flat Earth isn't in there, I'm very happy. Okay, good.
Yeah, yeah. You do weirdly get it occasionally. And you get somebody asking, not necessarily because they believe that, but because they know someone who really very strongly holds that belief. And so, hey, what can you tell them to try and win them over? And I'm like, well, pretty much nothing, because there's enough evidence out there already. And even if they came through a not as great as we'd like for it to be school system, you still got exposed to a lot of the ideas that would have helped debunk that set of beliefs. And we know now that there's just people who are not going to let go. It doesn't matter what you tell them.
True.
They're the ones that choose. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. They choose to pay attention to and listen to the things that only support their side of the argument. So at some level, it doesn't matter how much critical thinking you try to get them to do or how much evidence you try to explain in such a, you know, as simple a way as possible. There's that population that you're just never going to win them over. And you have to learn how to cut your losses and move on. And it's really hard.
It is. You're reminding me of a program that I was involved with probably over 20 years ago. The Astronomical Society of the Pacific, Andy Fracknell, you know him?
Andrew Fracknell? I do. I've known Andy for years. Adore him, respect him so much.
Yeah, he had a program where he linked amateur astronomers with schools. And this was probably 20 years ago. And I signed up for it. He had a 2-day workshop with the astronomers to talk about how do you go into a classroom. This is what you need to look for at this different. I think I was sent to fifth grade.
Is that Project Astro?
Project Astro. Yeah.
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 Project Astro.
Yeah. And for like 5 years, I was linked to this one elementary school, and I'd go in and I would do star parties and talk to the teachers. And I handled their astronomy unit for like a month, and it was great. It was that, but that, I don't think that exists anymore. Project Astro.
I honestly, this is embarrassing too, because I am an ASP member, and Andy Fracknoy is one of the colleagues that I hold in just the highest regard. Yeah. And I don't know for sure if they still have active funding so that they're able to pursue a lot of that. I know that it's not that it's completely gone away, but I think you're correct. I think it might be a legacy program now that they just kind of, you know, they make sure that materials and stuff are still available. The things that they can make available, they make them available. But I don't think it is an active program. Yeah. I do remember.
And the amateur astronomers I worked with, they all loved it. They loved going in the classroom. And because you see little kids' face light up when you tell them about the moon and you demonstrate an eclipse, you know, type of thing. Yeah. It's just,
wow. Kids are one of the most bizarre audiences, right? Because they're both super fun and actually really difficult because kids are, most of them, they don't have that, you know, that bad experience yet, right? So the desire hasn't been sucked out of them yet. And so they're still eager to learn. If something grabs their interest, you can see it, right? They don't have that filter. The enthusiasm is right there. And you can totally get them on board if you know how to do that. But on the other hand, they're really difficult because they don't have those filters. And so you can't just hand wave. When they ask you questions, you can't hand wave any of that away, right? I mean, they expect answers. And so they keep you on your toes. You really have to know what you're doing before you go into, you know, be a classroom with a bunch of kids like that. We do kids at college here at MiraCosta every so often. And we've done some other outreach with those kinds of groups. We have a STEM fair occasionally. And same thing. It's just, their faces, they just light up with that. Wow, really? That's so cool. And I remember thinking, yeah, when I was your age, I thought the same thing. Space is cool, right? And then all of a sudden they ask you a question and you're like, because the kinds of explanations that you would give in an Astro 101 classroom don't work, right? I mean, you have to make it not only age appropriate, but in terms of their cognitive development, right? You have to use the appropriate language for the level of processing that those kids are able to do. And for some people, that's very difficult to do. And it's very difficult for all of us. I think I've done it long enough that I'm certainly no expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I've had my you know, I've been nailed to the wall by kids groups before enough that I know what to expect now. And so I kind of have to, I kind of practice a little bit more, I think, before I give any sort of a presentation to kids than I do for probably an audience that's more my own age, just because I'm afraid that I'm going to give them a bad experience. If not because I can't answer all of their questions, but I just don't want it to come off as I'm unprepared. I want them to come away with that good experience of the excitement of something about the universe. And also too, that it's okay to not know something. It's okay. You don't have to know everything. Nobody knows everything, and that's okay. But you have to do it in a way that it doesn't turn them off. So I think that's one of the hardest things that we do, I think.
So in a few words, how do you fix science education?
I started to say, but I don't want that to count as one of my few words, because I don't know. I don't think I have a few. I don't know. Because from my perspective, which again is the general education introductory college classroom, mm-hmm. it seems like students may not be given the right tools to understand how to think about something. They don't necessarily have good problem solving skills. And I don't mean mathematically. I mean that too, but that's a layer above. I would argue that there's no point in trying to program everybody with all these mathematical tools unless they know how to think about things appropriately. And it seems that that's probably the biggest thing, that there's still so much that's memorization, and there's so much that's, they have to cram so much into such little time, and possibly with no resources or very minimal resources, mm-hmm. that it ends up being that experience for a lot of folks. So by the time they get to me, they expect the same thing. They expect that they're just going to have a class. And to be fair, some days they do. I mean, nobody's on all the time, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they oftentimes expect it to be memorization. They expect to just memorize, because the number of times that instructors at that introductory college level, and not just astronomy, just every subject at that introductory level, have students come to them and say something along the lines of, but I'm an A student. I just don't understand how I'm getting a C. I'm doing everything right. And something to that effect. And if you have the time and the resources to kind of drill down with that student, what do they mean when they say, I'm an A student, that I'm doing everything right, I'm doing everything you said I'm supposed to do, then more often than not, once you're able to peel back some of those layers, you realize it basically comes down to they've memorized some stuff, and they don't exactly know how to, they don't know how to argue with evidence. They know how to argue, just not with evidence.
Interesting.
And that's necessary for so many things in life. And so that's why I try to make our Astro 101 courses, they're heavy on those skills as well. I mean, we do it with the Astro content, but I want them to come out of that class knowing that, oh, I've got to have a reason for this. I mean, it's okay to not have reasons, but I need to acknowledge when I don't have reasons. And if I'm going to back up something with evidence, I need to know, what does that mean? What evidence do I have? How can I use that to convince someone that this is the right way to go? And we spend a lot of time in my classroom doing that, trying to convince someone. So I think that's probably, for me and the colleagues that I work with most often, that's probably one of the biggest things I think that we see.
Cool. Now, like I said, you came into my radar through Star Trek. Are you a Trekkie?
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah? Star Trek?
Oh yeah.
What's your Star Trek?
I was a TNG person. Okay. That was my first. Okay. I was shown the original Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know if I knew about it before or not, because I was born in 72. So obviously the original Trek had been gone for a while. I know that there were some reruns later, there were some syndications, but I don't remember watching any of that kind of stuff as a kid. There are other shows that I do remember seeing, but TNG came onto the radar when I was in high school when TNG started. So I kind of latched onto it then. And for a while, people knew that they could buy me Star Trek stuff, and that was a safe bet. Okay. I got a Star Trek. I got a TNG communicator cake for my birthday one year.
Oh my.
Yeah, one of my Halloween costumes was one of those, the little cheapo uniform top in the packet, right in the plastic bag that they hang in the Halloween store. Yeah, so that was one of my first ones. That was actually my first Star Trek uniform. That was, I guess, cosplay. We have to call it cosplay now.
Yes, we do.
Which I'm afraid I'm guilty of now. I'm at a pretty high level.
I am too. Very cool. So,
yeah.
Very cool. And do you own a telescope?
I do, but I did not own it until 2017. I never owned a telescope until 2017.
Don't apologize. What do you use it for?
I actually just use it for the occasional, you know, out in the yard, just take a look at the planets is usually what I use it for. Okay. Every once in a while, the moon. Mm-hmm. But planets are a big thing. Usually, you know, if I have company, if I have somebody that, you know, is staying with us, or even people in the neighborhood, like the next door neighbor or something like that. Or if there's something going on, right? There's a nice conjunction, right? Or I think, oh, Andromeda is actually in a good place. I could actually see it tonight. Then that. But I never owned one because I started graduate school in the mid to late 90s. And so I was always at a place that always had telescopes. And so if I needed one for something, I could just borrow one. So I never needed one. And I guess I went kind of hog wild when the solar eclipse of 2017 was going to happen. And I thought, well, I know I actually don't want to watch it with a telescope because I just want to see it with my eyes. Right. I knew this, but they were having such great deals on telescopes that I was like, well, I just need a little one. So I have like a 4-inch reflector.
Okay.
It's a Newtonian. It's one of the tabletop Newtonians that I bought from Orion. And like I said, it's small enough that it's not a big deal, right? I can just grab it. I can set up like a TV tray out in the yard, right? And I can just sit it on it and it's fine. It's good to go. Cool. So that was my first telescope. I still have it.
Cool. Are you going to go anywhere and watch the total solar eclipse?
I don't think so. I really wanted to, but I did not plan very well. So also too, school's in session, right? It's a Monday school's in session. And I am the only full-time astronomer. So that means someone's got to figure out what happens with my classes. So as the only astronomer, it's not easy to miss class, even when you legitimately have to miss it for being sick. It's not an easy thing to take care of. So I just kind of drug my feet. I didn't plan very well. I got lucky in 2017. My mother's house, which is just outside of Nashville, was along the path of totality. So, I was on sabbatical. Yeah, I was on sabbatical then. So I just went home.
Nice.
I got to watch it on the back porch. And we got very lucky. It was a little cloudy beforehand and I was getting all upset about it. And then it's like that stereotypical, the heavens just opened up and here's your solar eclipse. And it was absolutely the coolest thing I think I've ever seen.
Yeah,
it was my first total solar eclipse. So it was fantastic. I'd seen plenty of partials, but that was my first total.
Nice. Yeah, it's a once in a lifetime thing.
It really is.
Yeah. That's very cool. Well, Rika, do you have anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Look up every once in a while. And if you want to ask a question of an astronomer, look me up. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram.
Cool. And I'll put your contact information in the show notes.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, this has been a real pleasure. And yes, you are passionate about teaching. I'm sorry to tell you, but you are.
I'm afraid you all might be right.
I hear that in your voice. So any student would be lucky to have you as a teacher.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. You're very kind.
Okay. Well, you have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Observer's Notebook Podcast. Again, I want to thank Professor Rika French for coming on the podcast today. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed chatting with her. We upload a new episode of the Observer's Notebook on the 1st and 15th of every month. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. If you do, please rate and review us. I'd really appreciate it. You can also listen to us on Apple Radio, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, Spreaker, Google Play, Stitcher, Amazon Echo, Spotify, and the podcast is also available on our ALPO YouTube channel. Head over there and subscribe to that as well. You can help support the podcast by donating to it via Patreon by giving up to $35 a month,
where you'll receive 1 year's membership to the Alpo and producer credits on the podcast. And with that, I want to thank the producers of this podcast, Steve Seedentop and Michael Moyer, for their continued generous support of the Observer's Notebook. Thank you very much, gentlemen. A link for Patreon as well as a link for the Alpo is in the show notes. You can get a hold of me at CometMan@CometMan.net or on Twitter or X at @ObserversNBPod. Until next time, hope as we always have clear and steady skies. Thanks for listening.